It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Environmental Protection Agency has relaxed its pollution enforcement efforts, citing the ongoing novel coronavirus outbreak. We'll talk to a reporter about the impact this could have on the environment. First, beans are not the most glamorous of food choices to a lot of people. And if having beans for dinner or lunch doesn't sound exciting to you, you may not be alone. But our Food Friday guest wants to inspire us to get into the kitchen and find some fun in cooking beans, and he's going to give us some tips and recipes to help add some more wow factor. Joe Yonan is the food and dining editor at the Washington Post. He's the author of several cookbooks, including his latest, Cool Beans, the ultimate guide to the world's most versatile plant-based protein with 125 recipes. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, Joe, for people who aren't sold on beans yet, I know you are a big fan. Sell us. Why do you love beans?
So I think beans are really one of the most versatile things that you can have in your pantry, and we're all looking for that more than ever right now. You know, they're unique. They're the only food that the USDA classifies as both a vegetable and a protein. And I find it amazing that they can provide such nutrition and versatility while being shelf stable. I mean, what other food provides that much protein and fiber and can be used in that many dishes and can sit on your shelf and just be ready for you to cook whenever you want it?
And Joe, in your book, you don't steer away from the tough questions, including something people think, I think, when they think about eating beans, if they don't do it all the time. Joe, what about the gas?
Rob, I don't know what you're talking about. Do some people have a problem with gas and beans?
I've heard rumors, Joe.
You've heard, and maybe you've smelled, Rob. the childhood songs that we all sang, the rhymes about the magical fruit or the musical fruit, depending on, I think, maybe where you grew up, are there for a reason. I mean, beans contain oligosaccharides. It's a carbohydrate that our bodies don't digest as well as some other things. So what happens is when that gets into our gut, it causes flatulence. And there are a lot of other foods that cause it as well. But there are also a lot of things that you can do to help, especially if you're particularly sensitive. There's pressure cooking beans can really help. There's things that you can add to the beans, like kombu, which is a dried seaweed that I always use to cook beans, really helps. There's herbs like epazote in Mexican cooking, and ginger and cumin all can help. And certainly soaking beans can help reduce the gas-causing effects of beans, if that's a problem. But I also think there's a lot of people who would say that the very thing that's happening in your gut is also feeding your gut biome. So the very thing that is causing the gas also is one of the things that makes beans really good for you. So maybe ultimately we might just try to get used to it.
And then dried beans versus canned, there's a place for both of them in your cooking, it sounds like.
Absolutely. In my book, most of the recipes call for cooked or canned beans. So you can cook a big pot of beans on the weekends like I always do and then use them in lots of ways, or you can use canned beans. There are recipes where I love for you to use dried beans. And if you haven't cooked beans from dried, I give you easy tips for doing it. It's really not very difficult, and I really want people to try it, because if you cook them right from dried, you end up with two really great things. Of course, the beans themselves, which can have better texture, and you can just have access to a lot of a larger variety of beans than you can get canned. But then you also get this incredible cooking liquid, which is really delicious, and you can drink it as a soup on its own. You can add it to sauces and stews. You can store the beans in it. They freeze really well, particularly in that liquid. So if all you've had are canned beans, I urge you to try cooking beans from dry. But at the same time, I love canned beans. They're a great, convenient product, and they're very well produced. And I think that they just make it that much faster for you to add beans to your diet. And I, of course, want that.
Talking to Joe Yonan, his new book is called Cool Beans, the ultimate guide to the world's most versatile plant-based protein with 125 recipes. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite bean dish, a favorite way to eat or cook beans? Or do you have a question for Joe? He probably has an answer. 800-642-1234. You shared a few recipes with us, Joe, and we've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one is really special to you, I understand. Lalo's Cacahuate beans with pico de gallo. Correct my pronunciation on this. Traveled to get this guy.
Yeah, so this is an incredible dish. I was in Mexico City on my honeymoon, and I was eating all sorts of beans all around. You know, it's a good place to do bean research. And there's a chef, Lalo Garcia, Eduardo Garcia, he goes by Lalo, his nickname. And he's known for his beans, and his beans, his bean reputation preceded him, I'll say. And we went, and we had this great conversation with him, and it turns out that he was using these really special beans that he talked about getting from this one region of Mexico, and he cooked them really carefully, and when we had them, they just really blew us away. I mean, they're simultaneously simple and really deeply complex at the same time, and it turns out that his secret really is that he cooks the beans fairly simply until they're tender, you know, fairly low heat. And then he makes a sofrito, which is that aromatic combination of, you know, garlic and tomatoes and chilies. And then he puts that in the beans after they're already tender, cranks up the heat, brings them to a boil, and then cooks them for another half an hour. And it really concentrates the broth and just adds all this incredible flavor to the beans. And then, yeah, there's a quick pico de gallo, which is just, you know, tomatoes, onions, chili, lime juice, cilantro, just a quick little salsa that you eat on top. And it turns out the cacahuate bean is the same bean as a cranberry bean or a borlotti bean. Cacahuate in Spanish means peanut, which is kind of what the bean looks like.
Yeah, let's talk about bean substitution here. If I want to make a particular recipe and I don't have cacahuate beans lying around, say, or whatever, how flexible can I be in my my bean selections?
So flexible. I mean, one of the really interesting things about beans to me is that they do have their unique qualities. You know, some are a little nuttier than others. Some are a little starchier. Some are a little creamier. Certainly, they look a little bit different, but you can substitute widely across beans for particular recipes. I give a lot of guidelines in the book if people are interested in doing that. So, for instance, this recipe uses these, in Spanish they're called cacahuate, but they're more familiar to Americans as cranberry beans or Italian Americans as borlotti beans. You can use those. This would be delicious with pinto beans or black beans, really a lot of different kinds of beans. And the same thing really goes for a lot of recipes. I mean, a chickpea is fairly unique, right? So a lot of things that you would make with chickpeas, it's certainly going to be different if you just added, you know, use a cannellini bean instead of a chickpea, but it's not going to be bad. It's still going to taste good.
Well, let's bring on a caller now at 800. Matthew is with us in Blue Mounds. Matthew, hello.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Matthew?
Well, my wife is allergic to eggs, and we discovered, several months ago about the wonderful juice called aquafaba that's in the canned beans. And we whip it up in egg whites, and it's a great substitute for eggs in pancakes and cake mixes.
Matthew, thanks. And that is something you talk about in your book, Joe. Talk about that bean liquid as an egg substitute in our baking and elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Matthew, because it's really magical if people have never done this or used it or seen it. But basically, a French pastry chef who's vegan many years ago was looking for a vegan substitute for eggs, and he was sort of noodling around, and he happened to have a can of chickpeas in front of him, and he realized that the liquid looked like it had a similar viscosity to egg whites. And so he thought, well, I wonder if it would beat up like egg whites. And so he So we just started whipping, and guess what happened? They actually beat up just like egg whites. And so I play around with them a lot of places in the book. I think aquafaba is just really kind of an incredible thing. I use it in a chocolate mousse recipe in the book, for instance, that's basically my adaptation of Julia Child's classic deep, dark chocolate mousse. And I barely changed anything. I just figured out how much aquafaba would work. And you melt the chocolate with the seasonings, and you beat the aquafaba with a little cream of tartar, just the way you would with egg whites. It helps stabilize them. It beats up into stiff peaks. It gets all white and glossy. You add a little sugar to it. You fold it into the mousse, and it sets just like mousse. You can make meringue with it, pavlova, all that kind of stuff, and it just adds this silky texture. I prefer chickpea liquid for this purpose because the chickpeas are so mildly flavored, so you don't really want your chocolate mousse to taste like beans, right? So the chickpea liquid seems to work the best, and I also prefer it from the can because while you can use the liquid from cooking chickpeas at home, you know, it needs to be a certain concentration to work, and also any beans that I'm cooking at home, I like to season them. And you don't want your aquafaba typically to taste like garlic or bay leaf or anything like that either. So that's one of the things that I reach for the can for.
We're talking to Joe Yonan, the food and dining editor of the Washington Post. He's the author of several cookbooks. We're talking about his latest. It's called Cool Beans, the ultimate guide to the world's most versatile plant-based protein with 125 recipes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of cooking with beans? Do you have some favorite recipes or methods of cooking them? Do you have questions about cooking, maybe something you're going to do this weekend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few of Joe's recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Joe Yonan. He's the food and dining editor at the Washington Post. He's the author of several cookbooks. His latest is Cool Beans, the ultimate guide to the world's most versatile plant-based protein. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to cook and serve beans? Do you have a question on how to spread them out into more things? He's got everything from salads to entrees to desserts to beverages in his book. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Anne is with us in Stevens Point. Anne, hello.
Hello. We have found a great way to prepare beans. We simply can them in our pressure cooker by doing this. We take pint jars, and you put in a half a cup of dried beans plus maybe a fifth a cup, and a little bit of salt, maybe half a teaspoon. Fill it with boiling water. Put on your canning lid. Put all your jars in your canner. Pressure cook them for at 10 pounds for about 70 minutes. And voila, you got 18 or so jars of beans right off the shelf. And we've been doing this. I just did it last week. They're better than the store-bought canned beans, much cheaper, and one whack and you got it done. It's really great. It's so simple.
That's fantastic. And that's planning ahead. Joe, what do you think?
Well, I think that Anne needs to be careful because she's going to get a lot of people emailing and calling her asking if she can mail them these home pressure canned beans. No, I've never done this myself, but I know people who have, and I am totally jealous. I don't have a pressure canner, but we actually had a writer for the Washington Post who writes about all manner of preserving write a piece about this very thing a couple of years ago, and I was jealous then, and I'm jealous now. Yeah.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Joe, I mean, this beans are a pretty cheap way to get a filling meal, aren't they?
Oh, I mean, Rob, can you think of anything cheaper, honestly, that gives you that kind of nutrition and protein? I mean, sometimes people complain about the price of these really beautiful heirloom beans like the kinds that are sold by one of my favorite purveyors, which is this company, Rancho Gordo, out of California. And so their beans are about $5 a pound, which is, I don't know, three or four times the price of so-called commodity beans or really large-scale commercial beans that you would get in supermarkets. But even at $5 a pound, when you think about it, a pound of beans really is at least eight servings for $5. So what else would give you that kind of protein and nutrition and eight servings? If you were talking about chicken, you would need two chickens to feed eight people. And if it was a, you know, farm fresh, organic, pasture raised chicken, which would be the chicken equivalent of those Rancho Gordo beans, that would set you back, I don't know, $25, $30 for those two chickens at least. So yeah, beans have long been associated with poverty and, you know, people trying to make ends meet. And I think that might be one of the reasons why they haven't been as hip as they've gotten recently. But, you know, now that we're in this terrible, in the middle of this terrible pandemic, and we have, you know, stockpiled our pantries to try to, you know, make sure that we've got good food to last us for a while, I think more and more people are realizing just how incredible beans can be.
Let's go back to our callers. Helene is with us in Lake Delton. Helene, hello.
Hi there, Rob and Joel. I had just recently read a review of this book by Joe's in a food page, in an article, in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. And he talked about cranberry beans, Borletti beans, and I know you've spoken about them, but where can I get them? That's what I needed to know.
Interesting. They may not be in stores everywhere outside of big cities. Do you see them getting more available, Joe, or do you have an online source you might be able to point someone toward?
I list a lot of online sources in my book. You know, like I said, I love Rancho Gordo for their beans, but there are other sources. There's a really good company based in the South called Camellia, which specializes in a lot of beans that are popular in Southern cooking. And there's a really great company out of New York called Galustians that imports a lot of beautiful beans. The cranberry / Borletti beans, I would say one thing to think about is you might actually have farmers near you that grow them. I wouldn't be surprised. But I would also look at if you have any access to Italian markets. The Borletti bean is really popular in Italian cooking, so you can often find them there. They're more and more available in stores. I also see them, another good source, and I know that they sell cranberry beans, is Bob's Red Mill, which is the really wonderful grain specialist company out of the Pacific Northwest that also sells some nice beans.
Thanks for that call. Hope that helps. We're talking to Joe Yonan. It's Food Friday. We're talking about his new cookbook, Cool Beans. Back to your calls now. Nancy is on the line in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I really like getting these packages of 12 or 14 different kinds of beans that come in the same package and cooking them into a wonderful, wonderful soup. And the flavor is greatly enhanced if you add a tomato product as well. But I have discovered that you cannot add the tomato product until the beans are at least half cooked, because somehow kind of molecular situation is occurring that allow the beans not to fully cook or even half get cooked if you add the tomato product too soon. And I also greatly like cooking lentils with andouille-style sausage. These soups are... They make you feel as if you've died and gone to heaven.
Oh, thank you so much, Nancy, for sharing that. Joe, have you run into that? Is that a thing if you add your...
Of course. Yeah, of course. You know, acidic, if the cooking environment is too acidic, it slows down the softening of the beans. That's particularly true if your water is particularly hard. You know, if you're using more, I found that if there used to sort of be the idea that you couldn't put any tiny bit of acidity into beans from at the beginning, or you were really, in for delaying the beans a lot. I find that unless it's more than a couple tablespoons, 2 or 3 tablespoons, that's true. You can put a small amount in at the beginning and it's fine. But if you've got particularly hard water, it's particularly difficult. But you can reduce the acidity of the atmosphere by adding a little baking soda too, a little pinch of baking soda. So this isn't something that I'm saying you would do just so that you could add tomatoes. But if you are one of those people who have found that something like chickpeas, never, ever, ever seem to get tender, which I've heard people tell me this, it usually is because your water is hard, and adding a little pinch of baking soda can really help.
Thanks, Nancy, for the call. In our last minute or so, Joe, do you have bean making plans for the weekend?
Oh, Rob, always. Always. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is really, I cook a pot of beans pretty much every weekend, and then I store them in the fridge. And I use them in all sorts of different ways. So I'll make tacos one night with them. I'll make maybe veggie burgers with mushrooms one night. I'll, certainly make a soup or a stew one night. Toward the end of the life of the beans, that's when I usually start pureeing them and making dips, that kind of thing. But, yeah, every weekend is a bean weekend, Rob.
Joe, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's Joe Yonan. He's the food and dining editor at the Washington Post. Several cookbooks. We've been talking about his new one. It's called Cool Beans, the ultimate guide to the world's most versatile plant-based protein with 125 recipes. We've got a few recipes he shared with us there, including a mushroom kidney bean burger. He just mentioned those bean burgers. You can find that on there. Also a soup and a chocolate red bean and rose brownie recipe. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday is the place to find those recipes and many more. Coming up after the news, the ongoing novel coronavirus outbreak has led the EPA to relax enforcement rules for businesses that pollute. We'll find out what that can mean. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a historian and expert on leadership shares some of her observations on how our leaders have been showing up during the coronavirus pandemic. First, the Environmental Protection Agency announced yesterday that it would slow its enforcement of pollution regulations as the coronavirus outbreak continues to spread nationwide. The EPA cited requests from businesses as the outbreak threatens production and the greater economy. But the move from the EPA comes as the White House makes ongoing moves to relax or remove environmental regulations. Lisa Friedman is a reporter on the climate desk focusing on climate and environmental policy in Washington for the New York Times. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
On a practical level, what changes under this announcement from the EPA?
Well, this is a pretty broad relaxation of the rules that that chemical companies, utilities, oil refineries, basically any regulated industry has to report air and water and hazardous waste pollution. If under federal laws, a company or entity emits too much of a given pollution or substance into the water, they're required to monitor that, report it to the EPA, and that is the that is being waived right now in a broad sweep for entities because of what EPA has said is a discretion that they are using based on concerns that they're hearing from businesses that because of stay at home orders or other restrictions related to COVID-19, their companies are not able to meet these requirements right now.
Yeah, did they cite the kinds of companies or individual companies that had made these requests, or just refer to sort of a general pattern?
They refer to a general pattern, but we know from recent days and reporting that the oil industry and the coal industry have made specific requests to the EPA for in letters to Andrew Wheeler, the administrator, asking for blanket temporary relief for the industry through enforcement discretion, waivers, delayed deadlines.
What's been the reaction from environmental groups and others who have been critical of this decision?
Sure. I mean, you know, I've talked to a lot of people last night and today, and, you know, the reaction to this, I think, really breaks down on party lines. Environmental groups and frankly, folks who have been involved in compliance in Democratic administrations have described this document to me as stunning. Cynthia Giles, who led enforcement under the Obama administration, called it essentially a nationwide waiver of environmental rules. She said it's so far beyond my reasonable any reasonable response. I'm just stunned. Gina McCarthy, the former administrator of the EPA under President Obama, called it a license to pollute. It does not allow companies to get away with excessive pollution, but Ms. McCarthy's point was, if you don't have to monitor, how do you know if there are violations of pollution levels? At the same time, I've also spoken to a number of attorneys who represent regulated entities who have told me they find this reasonable. I spoke with Granta Nakayama, who led enforcement under George Bush II, and he called it a very sensible, straightforward guidance. He said he doesn't read it as providing a blanket assurance of giving polluters a free pass. You know, I spoke to another lawyer who said that at a time like this, you know, companies really need some relief from the government. But the concerns among the environmental environmental community at large, you know, are really overriding. And there's a lot of fear that if companies are given a reason not to monitor, they'll take it. And if monitoring isn't done, then we won't know if there are excessive pollution levels in our air and water.
Talking to Lisa Friedman from the New York Times, looking at an EPA announcement that they would be relaxing pollution enforcement during the COVID-19 outbreak. Lisa, is there an expiration date on this policy?
There isn't. The agency stressed to me that this is temporary, but no one knows when this pandemic will end. And so this is, you know, it's retroactive to March 13th, and it will last for an undetermined time through, you know, while the outbreak is, you know, while the country is dealing with this outbreak.
And you've also written, Lisa, that this comes amid kind of a flurry of activity at EPA to roll back or relax some other general environmental regulations, not temporarily, but permanently. What kind of things are going on?
You're absolutely right. I mean, as you know, as the administration is giving those that it regulates some breathing room because of the restrictions around that, you know, many of us face, having to work from home, et cetera, around the coronavirus, there remains, what I'm told by more than a dozen federal employees now, a relentless pace inside the agency to finish regulations. And the agency says it's going to treat things on a case-by-case basis, but so far has not allowed for any extensions of any proposed regulatory rollbacks in light of the coronavirus. So what's on deck? A number of big things. In the coming days, we can expect a final regulation weakening the automobile emission standards that President Obama set. The administration is finishing a rushing to finish a rule that would take the wildlife cop off the beat and remove any fines or prosecution for businesses that or other entities that kill migratory birds if the express intention of the action was not to kill the birds. So by that I mean if there is an oil spill like the BP spill that killed, you know, thousands and thousands of birds, but the intention of the spill was not to kill birds. You know, in that case, the BP, you know, paid some very heavy fines for the death of those seabirds. If this regulation is finalized, as they're hoping it will be very soon, companies will never face those kinds of fines again. There's regulations rolling back mercury restrictions from power plants, coal ash. You know, that's sort of just the tip of the iceberg. And the deadline here is summertime, at the latest, out of a concern that if a Democrat wins the White House or control of the Senate, it could be easier to roll back some of these provisions.
We'll keep watching that. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today. That's Lisa Friedman. She reports on climate and environmental policy in Washington for the New York Times. She joined us today to talk about the EPA's announcement that it would relax pollution regulations amid the ongoing coronavirus outbreak. Coming up, what are some attributes of great leaders in the face of crisis? We'll talk to an expert on leadership about the moment we are in. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Federal Department of Education is making changes to its student loan policies during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll find out what's different and how it could impact people with student loan debt. Now, Nancy Kane has done a lot of researching, thinking, and writing about periods of emergency and heightened fear. And in particular, she's focused on how great leaders act and respond during those times. Nancy is a historian and the James E. Robinson Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. She's the author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Thank you for being back with us. We've talked, of course, about Forged in Crisis. As we go through this coronavirus pandemic, what lessons from the past do you find your mind going right back to?
You know, a host of moments. There's lots about this crisis that's new, but there's a lot that has parallels in our history. So think about Abraham Lincoln in the crucible of the Civil War, Franklin Roosevelt, right, taking office in the midst of widespread, you know, financial panic and the prospect of the monetary system collapsing, Winston Churchill holding off fascism all alone, right, while Britain stood there as the last bulwark in 1940 and 41. And, you know, people like Diane Nash and, you know, Ella Baker, these women in the civil rights movement who just over and over and over again walked into crisis. And these people display a set of behaviors. They're not genetic codes. They're things we can all think about and employ that I think are important. Everything from get comfortable with ambiguity and chaos. Recognize you're not going to have a playbook here. You're going to navigate point to point and improvise and learn and make mistakes and then, you know, learn again and pivot to, you know, you've got to address the fear of the people that follow you. This is as true for mothers and fathers and teachers as it is for, you know, Andrew Cuomo, who I think is emerging as a very, very impressive, courageous leader, to you're always moving between brutal honesty and credible hope. And that means presenting the facts and the actions that those facts lead us to day by day and helping paint a picture of the future and pointing over and over to the collective resources we all have, you know, our resilience, our determination, our spirit of giving and unity, the resilience that people have to weather a crisis. So a host of things that are very, very relevant right now.
one fear I think that people in leadership positions have that comes up in the media is, are we talking about this as we present facts in a way that inspires panic? Do we need to steer clear of some of the worst facts out there because we don't want to panic people? Or do we need to get that truth out there and find other ways to prevent that kind of fear and panic from spreading?
So I think this is, again, about it's about wisdom and deftness, right? It's both. You're going to tell the story, but you can't tell the story without pointing to what are the resources. And these are both practical, right? Practical, 60,000 healthcare workers showing up in New York when Governor Cuomo says we need retired health workers, the facts, and our internal resources, right? We have the resilience. We have the conviction. During 1940, the British government published, posters and signs that said, courage, determination, conviction, laughter will get us through. And that was really important to stoking the fires of the British public away from panic and toward, if God is our witness, we'll fight him on the beaches. So we need both, and we're not getting much of this latter, and not from the executive branch of the White House and not from the media, and that's important. We need it.
And you have made a big point as you talk about leadership, and you were starting to touch on this earlier. Leadership isn't just about world leaders or governors or corporate leaders, whatever. What should we all be thinking about in our own lives as we consider leadership in tough times?
Well, a couple of things for leading ourselves or leading each other here. One is, and this is I think particularly important for all kinds of folks that have young people or older people looking to them for guidance, people who are more prone to fear or have less experience with very difficult moments. And that is, how are you showing up every day? Are you showing up panicking? Are you showing up frazzled? Are you showing up particularly anxious? Are you showing up scattered? Or are you finding ways to ground yourself and to, show up with your core muscles tightened and your shoulders back so that the people that need you to exemplify, right, some kind of courage and solidity are seeing that. This is really important in households, I think. A second thing I think that's really important is, how are you organizing the days and the days of your people. So Shackleton, this Antarctic explorer that we talked about a year or so ago when we were talking about Forged in Crisis, he had a version of this problem: isolated people, lots of danger, lots of fear. And one of his most important prophylactics with fear or tonics for diluting it was to give all his men a routine. And it didn't vary every day of the week. It varied once a week. We shifted duties. We walked from 3 to 4. We walked around the iceberg for exercise. From 5 to 7, we prepared dinner. From 7 to 8, we spent time together, not talking about the crisis, but telling stories or playing card games. So routine and physical order and I think physical labor, which are really important aspects of every household leading themselves in a productive, non-panicking way.
Talking to Nancy Kane, historian and author at Harvard Business School. She's the author of the book Forged in Crisis. We're looking at leadership in tough times, from world leaders to the rest of us, too. Nancy, as you look at leadership we're seeing today in the United States, maybe around the world, who do you see embracing some of the lessons of the past? Who do you see with some work to do?
Well, I'd certainly put Governor Cuomo, who is emerging as our kind of national leader now, right? Rachel Maddow, right, who with a very particular ideological pulpit said, he's the president of the coronavirus. And I don't think that's far off. I'm not saying that as a political comment, but I don't think that's far off in terms of what he's demonstrated. Angela Merkel right away, right, I think went to the mat for her people to talk about, here's the significance of the crisis and here's the resources we're bringing to bear, not just medical, but also monetary and fiscal, right, to address the corollary of this crisis. Both those people, I think, are very important. I think Jay Inness, the governor of Washington, Gavin Newsom in California, we're now seeing a chapter of local, particularly state leaders, really stepping up with ingenuity, with this combination of honesty and credible hope, and with just a great amount of powerful, important, you know, step-by-step, point-by-point actions that are going to make an enormous difference, and then I would say lastly, are going to be with us for a long time. This is the defining experience of the next 30 years in this country. We will be remembered, as Lincoln said, in spite of ourselves, by how we act as individuals and as a society. And I think that is incredibly important for people to keep in mind as they look around and with their common sense and intuition and sense of humanity and decency evaluate our leaders.
I wanted to talk about something unique about this crisis. It's a case where all of us can make a difference, in effect, by doing nothing, by staying home. How do you rally people to be on board with this very important thing when it doesn't feel very heroic?
So I think, again, here we've got an absence. We've got a hole in the leadership fabric at the top of the country. So, you know, Churchill was very specific. He gave everyone a job to do kind of month by month, week by week during the Battle of Britain. We need a job to do. We need national leaders, and including our state leaders, to be kind of more explicit about this every day, because regular frequent communication from leaders is critical. Here's our job. You're going to stay in place. You're going to, within those parameters, see if there are ways of helping the most vulnerable, who are not only patients or victims of the disease, but also essential workers, from healthcare people to truck drivers to the folks in our grocery stores and pharmacies. And you're going to help try and do that, and you're not going to hoard, and you're going to use your innate strength, because we're going to get stronger here, to avoid mass panic, which can only destabilize all the other efforts to solve this crisis and get it under control.
This is emerging gradually, Nancy. There's still people out there who don't see it as a particularly big crisis, and then there's some places that are hard hit and you can't miss it. How do you make sure everybody is on the same page, given that we're experiencing this at different paces and with different, in some cases, partisan lenses?
Well, we are very handicapped by the lack of that kind of, you know, leadership and guidance and authority in the executive branch. And we don't have enough from Congress on this either, but particularly from that, the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, right? We don't have a president saying, look, this is a national crisis. We're going to get through it. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. And here's how we're going to do it. And here's what I need every citizen to do. We have nothing like that. So that is handicapping, right, the realization and therefore the right action on the part of many people right now who aren't living in a location hard hit by this, to do the right thing here and to know whether this is real or not. That's one of the many, many very destructive consequences of what's happening in the executive branch of the United States right now. Again, we will remember this, write about it, act from this knowledge for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, Nancy, you mentioned this is what we're going to look back on for years, probably decades. Give us a minute or so of advice on how to behave now in a way that we're going to look back on positively in 10, 20 years.
You know, many years ago, when my life was falling apart, that's what led me to write this book, a minister at Harvard, a non-denominational church, said, you know, in the midst of outer turmoil, we seek inner strength. And he gave a whole, you know, kind of set of sermons on this that he wrote in a white heat right after September 11th. And here's something that stuck with me on inner strength and how we will be remembered. Because crisis, I know this from studying it for 20 years, are great greenhouses for the making of our strength and our resilience and our compassion and our character. And for people who want to get better, here's what Peter Gomes was the minister's name, is what he said. He said, look, it is in the giving. If you're seeking inner strength, you will find empowerment and strength and a sense of resilience, not by what you can take, but by what you can give. And if you doubt this, my friends, he would boom in his, you know, sort of operatic voice, if you doubt this, just make an experiment. Just give to someone in some way, in whatever circumstances you can, and then witness what happens within you.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to historian Nancy Kane for joining us today. She's at Harvard Business School and the author of Forged in Crisis in Turbulent Times. She joined us for a look at what makes courageous, effective leaders in times of crisis, local or national. Yesterday, we talked to the director of a national video game museum about some great video games, past and present, and we asked you to share some of your favorites. Here are some more of your replies from the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Gerald, who says he's still an active video game player for 33 years now, began with the Nintendo Entertainment System, NES, and still have every modern console. Gerald says video games have come a dramatically long way. There's a game out there for everyone, whether they enjoy sports, action, racing, puzzles, or a more cinematic and hands-off experience. He liked Super Mario, Doom, and Final Fantasy, the series. Nicole says, my all-time favorite game was World of Warcraft, a far cry from the days of Mario Brothers and Sonic. Nicole says, I graduated from Nintendo to Sega, then to RPGs on PlayStation. I didn't initially want to play World of Warcraft because I knew I would get addicted. She did. She says, I spent 2 years in a cycle of work, game, sleep, repeat before I finally realized I needed to step away. Pete says simply Galaga. That was a great video game for a long time. You could only find it at bars with the fire button not working, but people have been restoring those. That's fantastic. Shandi says the original Mario Brothers at Putt-Putt. Oh, I remember playing video games at Putt-Putt Golf. Pac-Man, Dig Dug, Galaga again, Tron, Centipede, Asteroids, and Donkey Kong. You can keep sharing your favorite video games, past or present, at the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.